Now, the other, another interesting part of Garn St. Germain was it allowed the banks to take 6% loan origination fee on any loan they made. Now, what that means is that you go into a town, you buy a $100 million bank, you put up $3 million. The next thing you do is you loan that $100 million out, and you take a 6% loan origination fee, and you just put $3 million in your pocket.
So you're being paid to loan money to whoever. Exactly. Any shady wheeler or dealer, you're going to get your 6% fee, and the government will insure the loan if it goes bad.
Exactly, and you took it up front.
So you're encouraged to give bad loans by this bill.
In a sense, yes.
And they didn't make any difference to them if they were paid back or not, because they had their 6%
up front. Exactly. And this was called land flipping, and it was very common. In fact, one developer told the story of being in a courthouse, a county courthouse near Dallas, one afternoon, and a very, real prime piece of property was up for sale. And what they did was they lined a hallway in front of the county clerk's office with card tables. You ever hear this story?
No.
This is incredible. With card tables, okay? So the deed comes and sits on the first card table. Here's the buyer, here's the seller. They sign everything, pass papers, all the checks. But then they pass the deed to the next card table. New buyer.
Same property.
Same property.
Right.
And they pass it down this line.
And it would go up every
time. Each time the value would rise.
Okay, now, where was the money... where was the money coming in to do this? I mean, wasn't there a...
Yeah, that's right. Each buyer
had,
had it borrowed from a savings and loan.
So this is what increases the debt. So every time they do this, they put in their pocket the profit, but they increase the debt.
That's exactly
by
right.
By borrowing from the SNLs or whoever to finance these actions.
That's
so the
right.
debt grows.
So all of this development was like the figment of people's imagination. So everybody declared bankruptcy. I mean, it's a joke now, but if you look at the curves by year of bankruptcies in Texas, it goes in the boom, like that. And that's the reason. I mean, they just had no choice. So now the dream is over.
The party's over.
The party's over.
And the hangover is very heavy.
That's right. And so all the savings and loans now have to foreclose. Now, when they foreclose, in most of these deals, the property was set up as collateral. So now all the savings and loans suddenly are taking in all this property. Now they're taking in apartment buildings. They're taking in developments that have a few roads in them. And they got the golf course up. You know.
But no people
but
living there.
There's nothing there.
Right.
Yeah. Empty office buildings. They got nothing.
An update of the savings and loan situation, this time emphasizing the role of the government and how it contributed to the demise of the savings and loans and all the scumbags who were controlling them. Join us and Rob Widdowson right now on Alternative Views. Well, the savings and loan crisis thing has really struck a responsive chord around the United States. We've been getting more mail from the programs which we've done on the savings and loan crisis with Rob Widdowson than any other subject, even those of the CIA or the Kennedy assassination. people are astounded by it, and they want to hear more about it. And you're becoming a superstar. Everybody's getting these letters, you know, they want to know about you, and people stopping you on the streets. And not only that, Rob has become one of the country's experts and has been taken into the confidence of some of the high executives of these savings and loan institutions. Investment bankers are calling him up and spilling their guts to him, and business organization calling him. Tell us, what are we going to do? How are we going to get out of this? This is the weirdest situation I think I've ever seen, and all of this seems to be focused on you because you have been writing articles and been on TV, and people recognize you and think you've got all the answers.
Well, I don't have many answers, but I have been studying this pretty carefully for a year, and the more I probe into it, the more detail I see, naturally. And so one of the problems is that now that I've been doing it for so long, I have a kind of a responsibility to try and explain what I see happening and what has happened to cause this enormous financial disaster.
Rob, let's see today if we can get the big picture. So far, all the media has done in this SNL crisis is to blame guys like Neil Bush or Charles Keene, as if it's just a few entrepreneurs that went berserk, rich kids gambling with the taxpayers' money, that's all the savings and loan scandal really amounts to. But there's much more behind this, isn't it?
Yes. It appears that there were structural changes in many areas that relate to thrift banking that really created as much of this disaster as the these evil SNL owners like Keating and Don Dixon.
You mean like changes in the laws and policy of regulatory agencies?
And what the federal government did to these people is just brutal. I mean, for those people who are interested in conspiracy theories, I'm sure somebody could find something. Yeah, I'm not going to come up with anything right today, but I mean, there's some threads in here that are really nasty.
Yeah. Well, tell us about what some of these changes. Apparently, they made changes and lured some of these naughty guys into it.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. Okay. First of all, it's pretty well known that at the end of the 70s, the thrift industry was on the ropes because of rising interest rates, and the thrifts had their money invested in long-term mortgages. And as interest rates on deposits rose, people took their money out of thrifts and put them in money market funds, banks, and other agencies that give them a higher return. So now thrifts were carefully regulated and had been all throughout their history. They were designed just for single-family homes, basically. Well, in 1980, the first step was taken, and that was to lift the cap on interest rates and raise the amount of insurance for each deposit to $100,000. Okay, now that one's pretty well known. Now, in addition, right around that time, because the thrift industry was in so much trouble, the regulators began to grant what they call forbearances. Now, part of the regulatory apparatus was that each thrift had to maintain a certain amount of reserve money on hand. It was calculated as a percentage of assets, assets being outstanding loans and any property or any other asset that the thrift owned. And they had to maintain 5%, which means that if the thrift was liquidated on a given day, they had to have at least 5% left. Anything under that, and they were in violation of the rules, and technically they were insolvent. They could be closed. But because the whole industry was in trouble, the regulators took it easy on them, and they granted forbearances, which allowed them to carry a lower capital reserve than the law required. Now, what that effectively meant was, if you were a thrift owner, and that 5% capital reserve was really your profit, because if you liquidated the thrift on any given day, what was left over was what you took home. So, in the early 80s, with these four, when the thrifts were in trouble, there were many of the thrifts had no capital reserve, which meant that the owner had no more stake in the thrift. He had already lost his money, see. So
anything that he could grab then,
exactly,
in any way, was his.
Exactly. And turn into assets that could be personal or corporate that he could,
exactly,
control outside of the framework.
And
of
so
the
then it meant that he really had no loyalty to the organization.
Exactly. Because he had no money in it.
Oh.
He had already lost his money.
Okay.
So,
and this began actually with Carter, or when Reagan first came in as president?
Well, the problems in the thrift industry began in the 70s,
mm-hmm,
and it dates back to us going off the gold standard and floating interest rates and all of that.
It goes back to Nixon, really.
Uh-huh, exactly, right. 71.
And then the high inflation under Carter and the high interest rates.
Exactly.
And they forced them to give a lot of money. I was getting 17% at one time,
yeah,
for money market. Thrift certificates.
Prime rate got up over 20% at one,
right,
point in the 78, I think. So there's a point about the psychology here. The regulators were giving everybody a break because they didn't want to have to shut it all down. They didn't have enough money in the interest in the insurance fund to cover all these deposits anyway.
The FSLIC,
right. So the owners were kind of set up already psychologically. Now in 1982. The famous Deregulation Act occurs, and that's Garn-Saint-Germain. We've all heard of it.
We've talked about that, all the skullduggery and corruption that went on in that.
Right. Well, let me just go through a couple of the provisions of Garn-Saint-Germain and show how they had the kind of effect they had. First of all, they dropped the capital requirement from 5% to 3%. Okay, so that meant your reserves had only to be 3%. Now, that had an interesting effect, particularly with the people that wanted to buy in. Okay.
They didn't need as much.
So if you had a $100 million bank, a medium-sized thrift that was up for sale in a small town in Texas, for example, all you needed to come up with was $3 million to buy that bank, and you set that aside as a capital reserve, and you were off and running.
And some people bought some very big banks with even less than that.
Yeah, well,
there were some famous stories of this Florida guy.
Uh-huh, exactly, with promises that they were going to make it up, and they had investors and all of this. Now, the other, another interesting part of Garn-Saint-Germain was it allowed the banks to take 6% loan origination fee on any loan they made. Now, what that means is that you go into a town, you buy a $100 million bank, you put up $3 million. The next thing you do is you loan that $100 million out, and you take a 6% loan origination fee, and you just put $3 million in your pocket.
So you're being paid to loan money to whoever.
Exactly.
Any shady wheeler or dealer, you're going to get
your
6% fee
up front.
And the government will insure the loan if it goes bad.
Exactly, and you took it up front.
So you're encouraged to give bad loans by this bill.
In a sense, yes.
And they didn't make any difference to them if they were paid back or not, because they had their 6%
up front. Exactly. Okay. Now, the savings and loans were allowed by Garn-Saint-Germain to branch out into all kinds of investments. In fact, they were allowed to invest directly in commercial real estate projects. So what they all did was, the minute Garn-Saint-Germain was passed, they all set up a holding company, a construction holding company, sort of off to the side. And then they would loan money to the construction company, and the construction company would go ahead and develop property. So the first thing they all did was they designed office towers. And they counted on themselves to be a primary tenant. So they built themselves buildings. Okay?
They loaned themselves money, built themselves buildings.
Right, and then they charged themselves exorbitant rent,
which came out of the deposits
exactly.
of the savings and loans.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And they could take it as profit.
And their loan fee they got on top of all the rest of it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
God.
Now, another thing they were allowed to do, and this is, I mean, just gets more and more incredible, 100% financing. So, borrower comes into your bank, he's got this project he wants to do, he needs $50 million. Well, they never asked him what he was going to give him up front. They just said, okay, we'll lend you the $50 million. They didn't have to put up a dime.
They didn't check to see if the guy was had credit worthy or
Well, they
like
were
that?
Supposed to check that. It was called due diligence, but it was left for somebody else.
Diligence
to
was lacking.
Exactly. And as part of the deal, they would loan a little extra. Like if you wanted $50 million, they would loan you $58 million. They'd set the $8 million aside in an escrow account to pay off the interest the first year's premiums.
Oh my God.
Right. So the developer never put in a penny. The bank loans out the $50 million. Right? The payments are made on time. They're just pulled out of the escrow account that the bank also loaned as part of the deal. Right? So the developer didn't have to put up a penny.
So this encouraged a lot of development that wasn't needed. I mean, already Houston, for instance, had about a 50% vacancy rate on their office buildings, right? And throughout Texas, this uh-huh. was the case.
Exactly. Now, and there's a lot more.
And here in Austin, we got all these buildings and nobody's in.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right. Now, there's a reason for that, and I'm getting to
okay.
it. Okay. There's one other point I want to make about Garn St. Germain.
All right.
And this is really a killer. They were allowed to loan money on the appraised value of a piece of property, not on the purchase price, on the appraised value. So,
who is appraising?
Well, you go around town, you get an appraiser, but of course the appraisers are going, you know, they listen to the tone of your voice. You know, and if you're telling them you're going to build the Taj Mahal, you're going to cover it with mosaics this big and it's going to cost $100 million, well, you know, you're
suddenly that's the price.
Exactly. So, I mean, you bought a piece of land for $5 million and you're going to put a $100 million development on it, then $100 million was the appraisal, and that's how much you could loan out.
And was the appraisers getting kickbacks, or were they getting percentages based upon the appraisal?
Uh-huh. Of course.
That's standard fees,
uh-huh.
right?
Exactly. So, okay. Now, here comes a big kicker. One of the very first things that Ronald Reagan did when he got into office was he pushed through the Tax Reform Act of 1981. Now, there were two major clauses of this Tax Reform Act. One was it dropped the tax rate for the very wealthy, the highest bracket, from 73% to 28%.
Okay. That's a big drop.
That was a big drop. Freed up a lot of bucks. The second thing that it did, and this is the important thing for the savings and loan industry, is it changed the way depreciation worked. Now, when you buy commercial property, you're allowed to depreciate that property over the average length of existence of that property. So, for example, if you buy a building for $1 million and it's got a 20-year life, let's say, then you can depreciate the value of that property 5% every year for 20 years. Okay, which means that you can write that off your taxes. You take it off your gross income. Well, the Tax Reform Act of 1981 allowed for accelerated depreciation. So, instead of 5% every year for 20 years, you could write off 12% the first year, 10% the second year, 8% the third year. So in 3 years, you've dropped 30% instead of 15%. Okay. Now, what that meant was that you could get an enormous tax break. In fact, most of the people who invested went back and refigured their taxes 3 years in advance and took tax breaks on that too. So they made a fortune.
So they're deferring tax payments, right? They're waiting to the future to pay the taxes on it, and they're getting their deep discounts early on. Is that the way it worked?
Well, when you're allowed to depreciate the value of the property, it means that, you pay less tax at the beginning and more tax
later
on.
Right, okay. So it's deferring the tax.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Of course, they all plan to sell the properties after 3 or 4 years.
So they wouldn't pay
any
taxes.
Have to pay
any,
right, exactly. Right. So what this did was everybody wanted to build. Everybody wanted to develop, right? So, as you were saying, all of that development, all of those properties, were not built to put people in their offices.
To meet needs that people were demanding.
Demand. There was no market demand whatsoever.
Right.
It was a place to put your money, and it was an enormous tax shelter.
Right.
Okay. Now, this is going to come back to haunt people. Okay. Now, there's some other changes. There were changes in the appraisers' laws. One key one was something always troubled me was in 1983 and 1984 here in Austin, along Congress Avenue, our main avenue, all these office towers went up all at once. Mm-hmm. You guys ever notice that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it always bothered me. I mean, why was everybody building at once?
In all postmodern style. So.
Well, the reason was that the rules for appraisers were changed. Now, normally, if you put up a property, the appraiser would have to take into account the surrounding properties. So in other words, if you put up a luxury apartment building on a block with four other luxury apartment buildings, it's worth less than if it sits by itself, right? Naturally, market value. Well, under the new appraisal laws, appraisers did not have to take into account any building in the area that was under construction. So in other words, when they appraised one of those towers on Congress Ave, they didn't have to take into account the fact that there were five other towers being built right on the same street within a few blocks. Okay, so that the market value was completely inflated for all of those towers. Okay, now you couple that with the fact that you could loan on appraised values, and I mean, you had an inflation that went through the roof, and people began to do things called land flipping. Mm. Where they would buy a property. I'll give you an example. There's a guy named Louis Reese from Dallas. He was a developer. And in 1983, he bought a property in DeSoto, a town just south of Dallas, a 223-acre tract for $5.3 million. A year later, he set up a partnership with a guy from Holland, and he sold the property to himself and the partner for $10 million. A year after that, that partnership sold the property back to another Reese company. He sold it back to himself for $15 million.
Now, what's the point of this? I'm not sure I understand the financial benefit accrued from doing this land flipping.
Well, he would borrow the money from a bank to sell the property from himself to himself.
So he would take the profit himself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay, and the way he would do it is he'd get an appraiser to appraise the land at a higher value each time. So, and this was called land flipping, and it was very common. In fact, one developer told the story of being in a courthouse, a county courthouse near Dallas, one afternoon, and a very, real prime piece of property was up for sale. And what they did was they lined a hallway in front of the county clerk's office with card tables. Ever hear this story?
No.
This is incredible. With card tables, okay? So the deed comes and sits on the first card table. Here's the buyer, here's the seller. They sign everything, pass papers, all the checks. But then they pass the deed to the next card table. New buyer.
Same property.
Same property.
Right.
And they pass it down this line,
and it would go up every time.
Each time the value would rise.
Okay. Now, okay. Now, where was the money? Where was the money coming in to do this? I mean,
well,
wasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. Each buyer
had to borrow.
Had it borrowed from a savings and loan.
So this is what increases the debt. So every time they do this, they put in their pocket the profit, but they increase the debt.
That's exactly
by
right.
Borrowing from the SNLs or whoever to finance these actions.
That's
so the
right.
Debt grows, it doubles every time they, you know, double the price.
That's right.
Of this thing. So this is how the debt doubles and skyrockets.
That's exactly right. That's how all of these inflated values took place. Now, each borrower would have its own appraisal, and it would have its own idea for the property. Okay, so if we're going to build a Taj Mahal, somebody might want to paint it. Somebody else might want to put mosaics this big. Well, that's going to cost you more. Okay. So, all of this development was like the figment of people's imagination. Now, at the same time, or in the early 80s, Congress passed a law that said that savings and loans could go use new accounting procedures. Here's another change in an associated industry. The accountants, the way it worked was, let's say you had a piece of property and you sold it and there was a $20,000 loss just for fun. It never happened in those days. Yeah. But let's say there was a $20,000 loss.
Today.
Exactly. Well, in the old days, before these new accounting procedures were put in, you had to say minus $20,000 and subtract it out of what you have of your net worth. Well, these new accounting changes allowed you to spread that loss over 20 years. So you could divide it. So you lose $20,000, you spread it over 20 years, you subtract $1,000 each year. So even though you took the hit in 1983, for example, it never showed up on the books. So it was
like deferring the taxes, it's deferring the losses.
Exactly. And so the books looked great. I mean, you lose $1,000, so what?
God, the whole thing's a fairy tale then.
Exactly.
So it's like fantasy finance.
The whole
fictive capital.
Exactly. The whole thing was made up. Okay? It was a daydream. It's now our nightmare, but it was a daydream then. Now, at the same time, remember, and by the way, the accountants were also following the same pattern as the appraisers. The accountants were supposed to be independent auditors that went in and looked at the books. Okay, but remember, they were being paid a fortune to do it. And so, I mean, one of the prime examples, for example, is Keating. His parent company was called ACC, American Continental. He went to Arthur Young in 1986.
Yeah.
And now they were making about $20 million a year gross. Keating goes to him and says, I've got a $3 million account here. And I want you guys to cooperate. Well, naturally, they're going to cooperate.
They're going to do what he tells them to do.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, 2 years later, the guy who was in charge of that account suddenly left his job at Arthur Young and took a job with Keating for $1 million a year.
I mean, you know. Joining all of Keaton's siblings who were getting over $1 million a year
exactly.
for salaries.
Exactly. So, now, the other factor was the bank board itself. Now, the way the savings and loan industry was arranged was the federal overseer of all of the savings and loans was called the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. They had an office in Washington, and then they had 12 regional offices. And they had a dual function. They were there to support the savings and loan industry. For example, each of the 12 offices had a bank, a regional bank, and they would lend savings and loans in their jurisdiction, money if they needed it. They would support them in various ways, and they would promote them. They would help with advertising and all kinds of stuff. But at the same time, they were the regulators. So, I mean, they had this dual schizophrenic role to play. And for most of the time the savings and loans existed, the first 40 years, it was no problem because they were mom and pop industry. Everybody was pretty honest. Nobody was making a killing anyway. But when these other changes started to take place and things started to explode, nobody changed the regulatory structure. So there was this intense coziness, okay, between the regulators, the examiners, and the banks themselves. Let me give you an example. Right here at the University of Texas at Austin, there's a gentleman whose name is Robert Metlin. Now, Metlin is an expert in the world of thrift finance. Okay, that's his field, and apparently he's quite good at it. From 1983 to 1985, he sat on the board of directors of Lamar Savings.
The biggest SNL in town.
Right, exactly. Also the biggest bailout in town.
Which held our alternative views account, as well as my house.
Well, you'll be very interested in this. So, Metlin was on the board of directors of Lamar Savings. He was also on the board of directors of Lamar Financial Corporation, which was the holding company that owned Lamar Savings. Hmm. He was also... at the very same time, from 1982 to 1987, the head of the regional bank board.
How neat.
So he was the head bank examiner responsible for Lamar Savings.
At the same time, he was on their board and...
At both boards.
Both boards. And,
and in 1984, he was named the Lamar Savings Centennial Professor of savings and loan finance at the University of Texas.
Which means, is that an endowed chair?
Yes.
Which means he gets a hell of a lot of money for teaching over and above what professors normally
right.
get.
Exactly. And
that, so that
of course, that
payment.
Endowment came from Lamar Savings.
Right.
And at
nice,
the same time...
Nice circle here, huh?
Oh, well, it gets better. He was also on the Austin Chamber of Commerce, which was, of course, regulating or in promoting all this growth.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the University of Texas vice president for development.
That was also promoting growth and development.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So...
with certain savings and loans and corporate finance.
Need we say more? I mean, you know, cozy, I guess, is hardly conveys... the kind of
incestuous
we're talking about.
Well, it's just a typical inside game of most regulatory agencies and their clients.
Uh-huh, exactly.
But
this is just a little more egregious.
There is a difference here, though. I think the philosophical underpinnings of all this is the Reaganite philosophy of deregulation. Let the market solve all the problems, be it banking or development or savings and loan or whatever. So this is really the major example of Reagan's deregulation running amok. Pretty early on. Early on, the Garn Saint-Germain was touted as the triumph of the Reagan Revolution, of the deregulatory policies being extended to the whole realm of finance.
Well, that's true, but mm-hmm. you say the realm of finance, and remember, one of the key, the underpinnings of finance is the notion of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no free market here. There was no free market at all because all of that money
was guaranteed.
Right. So it was a joke.
Right.
It was a myth.
So it was socialism for the gamblers
for the
and
rich.
The market for the players.
Well,
it was just counterfeit. They were just legal counterfeiters
right.
without
right.
restraint. So what was happening here is that the government was opening all the doors. Come in, let him by the hand, open the cookie jar,
and
say, hey, we're going to leave here now, and you folks can
yeah, now
fun.
Don't you dare touch that cookie jar.
You
yeah.
know? I mean, if you screw up and spoil all the cookies, we'll give you another
we'll give
batch.
You more cookies.
Yeah, exactly. We got plenty in the back. So, you know, just to, what really happened was, at the same time, of course, all the thrifts are pulling in deposits from all over the country. The insurance insured deposits are $100,000. These $100,000 CDs, brokered deposits from all over. So the money's pouring in. The thrifts are pouring it out. Okay? They're paying developers who are overcharging them, who are paying architects, appraisers who are overcharging, who are contractors who are overcharging. Everybody's skimming. Everybody's taking their little
tight.
Piece of the action. Okay? So the boom is well underway. Everything's going fine. Now, they've got to pay high interest rates on these deposits to attract them,
right.
and that's taken a big cut. What's probably taken a bigger cut is the lifestyle. I mean, they built these office towers. They had to buy planes because they had to fly over these tracts of land to look at them, and they're doing deals all over the country now.
Limousines to take them to the airport.
Well, exactly. They had all of these...
Call girls to entertain their clients.
Exactly. Promotional parties. Ed McBurney spent $1 million on three parties. You know, 6% loan origination fees. You know, you're bringing in a lot of bucks. You get used to driving a Mercedes. You get tired of the Mercedes. You buy yourself a Lamborghini and so forth.
Well, this doesn't sound like mom and pop anymore.
Exactly.
Who used to own the SNLs. What we do is this whole new stratum of scumbags and charlatans move into the SNL industry
exactly.
and take it over.
In fact, there was a big split in the industry right that took place during this. Several of the old-timers who had owned savings and loans for years refused to play. And they just kept doing the same thing they'd been doing. They were laughed at by the high flyers. Who said, man, everybody's making a killing, let's go. But they refused. And in fact, there was almost a little secession. There was a secession, in a sense, from the U.S. League of Saving Institutions, which was the main organization, national organization. Several of these more conservative thrifts dropped out. And in fact, there are about 1,500 healthy thrifts left in the country. Most of them are those that...
didn't play the game.
Exactly, stayed conservative.
Oh,
so there might be a lesson there somewhere. Now, We got the boom going, and then all of a sudden, a bunch of forces began to converge. As we've said, these high interest rates they were paying, the high-flying living,
high cost
of living. In 1985, oil prices dropped. Mm-hmm. Been up to $30 a barrel, suddenly dropped to 11. Okay. So, right away, several of the developers and investors who were putting together these enormous projects that the savings and loans were funding defaulted. Okay. Now, that started the slide.
This is around 86?
This is 85.
85. Okay.
Okay. In 86 came the big hit. Okay, and the big hit was the second Tax Reform Act of the Reagan years, in which he reneged on all of the deals of the first Tax Reform Act. So in other words, accelerated depreciation, retroactively cut off.
Retroactively.
Suddenly, they had to refigure all the taxes back on a straight line life of the asset basis.
They say, hey, okay, I want my cookies back. They say, wait a minute, they flushed down. I mean, they're in,
that's right,
down the Arkansas
that's
River.
Right. And so
ago.
All of these people who had taken this enormous tax break suddenly
had to make it up.
And so they all, I mean, almost 100% defaulted on their deals. They couldn't make any payments. The escrow accounts that were set up as the original part of the deal were running out. And all of these deals fell apart. Now, the developers were in another serious bind because when a property was foreclosed, and if the S&L forgave the debt and didn't chase you, the IRS treated that forgiven debt as income. Okay, so if you were forgiven a $700,000 debt, then they sent a little form to the IRS, and the IRS said, well, you owe us taxes on $700,000. Plus, any depreciation that they did get from the now straight-line depreciation was treated as a capital gains. So they had to pay capital gains tax on what they had written off. So everybody declared bankruptcy. I mean, it's a joke now, but if you look at the curves by year of bankruptcies in Texas, it goes, and then boom, like that. Mm. And that's the reason. I mean, they just had no choice. So now the dream is over.
The party's over.
The party is over.
And the hangover is very heavy.
That's right. And so all the savings and loans now have to foreclose. Now, when they foreclose, in most of these deals, the property was set up as collateral. So now all the savings and loans suddenly are taking in all this property. Now they're taking in apartment buildings, they're taking in developments that have a few roads in them, and they got the golf course up.
But no people living there.
And there's nothing there.
Right.
Empty office buildings, they got nothing. Now this is... these foreclosed properties are called real estate -owned on the books of the banks. So they're known as REO property for short. REO was a real problem for banks, savings and loans, because, first of all, they had to take care of them. I mean, you got an apartment building, somebody's got to manage it, somebody's got to get the rent, somebody's got to clean them up, maintenance, all of that. They got to pay taxes. If you got a development that was half finished, you had to finish it. And suddenly, they were in the serious development business, and they didn't want to be. So, that was the first problem. The second problem was that REO was subject to regulatory write-down. Okay, now,
what does that mean?
Well, the regulators would come in and they'd look at the REO that you had on your books. If you were carrying, you know, they were supposed to be trying to sell us to get back their investment. If you couldn't sell it, the regulators would come in and actually arbitrarily drop the value.
Yeah. Well, which was realistic, though.
Exactly, because it wasn't selling.
Or it wasn't even developed in some cases.
That's right.
And they didn't have the capital to complete the project.
That's right, but you can see what this did to the bank, to the savings and loan. Right? The profits go down, no more bonuses based on profits. Their capital reserve go down, now they're technically insolvent. And the regulators are banging on the door, they're going to close them. In one case, I'll give you another example from Lamar here in town. They had a development out on Route 2222, it's out west of town here. Enormous development, golf course, a little water company, made water. 1,200 homes, many of them in the high dollar bracket. It was called River Place. Well, they sank $63 million into River Place. When they foreclosed on it, they got, I think, 100 homes, the golf course, and the water company, and the land, and the roads. Over time, the regulators wrote it down, and the eventual final write-down value was $5 million. So on that one deal, Lamar lost, gone forever, $58 million.
Which was actually in the pockets of all the people to start out with.
That's right.
The bank people and the construction people.
The appraisers, everybody who skimmed some of the action.
So the money is gone, but it's gone somewhere else, in their pockets or in offshore banks or CIA or mafia.
And the whole thing, remember that the whole value was originally inflated by those appraised values, by all of that. So REO property was an enormous problem for the SNLs. And this is where the owners, the executives, stepped over the line. Okay, now they've been living the high life for a few years.
Legally, huh?
Legally, originally.
Right.
Okay, even though we know it's a figment of their imagination, it was legal. But now they got all this REO and they got to get it off their books. So they developed some schemes to get it off their books. One thing they did, for example, was a simple deal called a sham transaction. You got a friend? Okay, you were the owner of the bank? You sell an apartment building to your friend. And you write into the deal, you will not be held responsible for this loan if you have to foreclose. And they'd put in the interest and all that. And, you know, you'd be allowed to take a couple hundred thousand dollars out of the operating expenses, or you'd get your money somehow. Okay. Now, what this did was it took the REO off the books, gave it to you while I'm looking for a buyer.
But I didn't have any responsibility because in the contract you said if I defaulted, I wouldn't be held liable.
Exactly. There was a case here in town, for example, another Lamar case. The owner had a friend named an Indian guy named Vijay Parikh. And there was an apartment building here in town that was REO. And Lamar sold the building to Vijay Parikh. And during the trial, he was tried and convicted of fraud. During the trial, it came out that Parikh didn't know how much the loan was that he was getting, what the interest rate was, what the payments were. I mean, he just didn't know anything.
They just gave him the money to take the thing off their hands.
Right, and of course, no money really exchanged hands. Yeah. They just said, the apartment building's in your name, and you just borrowed, you know, the worth of the apartment building from us.
Right.
And it's up to him to develop it and to run it.
Yeah, exactly. And he held it for 6 months or so. And actually, he was actually a pretty good property manager, apparently. And then a buyer was found, and it was sold. He didn't even know the name of the buyer, by the way, when it happened. Mm-hmm. He sold his own property. He didn't know who it was sold to.
It was all done by Lamar.
Yeah. So this was just a way to hide, get it off the books. And so these are the kinds of transactions that most of the indictments that you read about in the papers are focused on.
This is after 86 or 86
right.
and after.
86 and after was most, 85, 86 was most of these deals went down.
Well, what about some of these things that they did that you told in a previous program where SNLs would sell their bad assets to another SNL when they knew the bank examiners were coming in.
Exactly.
And then when the bank examiner left, then that SNL would sell them back to the original SNL.
Those were called daisy chains.
Yeah.
Now, and this is the same problem.
Are those legal or are those illegal?
Oh, they're illegal because it's a means of hiding the true worth of the bank from the regulators.
So they had a whole bunch of these schemes.
Exactly. Yeah, but they were all focused around this REO, which happened after 86 in 85 when oil prices dropped, and more importantly, when the other tax, the second tax reform act came through, and effectively cut the legs off of the industry. Well, I just wanted to clear up a couple of other kinds of deals that you may read about. Okay, there was one. We've already talked about daisy chains, and if it was just two savings and loans, it was called trading a dead horse for a dead cow. you take my dead cow, I'll take your dead horse. Yeah. There was also a kind of transaction called cash for trash. Okay, and this has become quite important, and is the thing that they're after Silverado about.
Sound like a TV program, then.
Exactly. Well, that's sort of the way it works.
Bad game show.
That's what it was like. Because here was the deal. If a developer came to the bank and said, I need $50 million to develop this development, the bank would say, fine, we'll loan you $50 million. But, actually, we want to loan you $60 million. And you take that extra $10 million and use it to buy some REO from us. So it was another way to get REO off the books. Now, remember I was telling you about this land flip up in Dallas with Lou Reese, who $5.3 million, he sold it to himself a couple times.
10, 15.
Right. Well, in 1985, Lamar Savings contracted with Lou Reese to buy the property from himself again, this time for $28.5 million. Okay, 2 years before he paid $5.3 for it. But they loaned him $37 million. Now, the extra was transferred to another company that Reese owned, and that company used that money as down payment for two shopping centers that Lamar owned that they had to foreclose on. Exactly.
So that's playing an inside game of circulating your bad investments.
Exactly. So once again, another trick to get REO off your books.
And was this illegal?
This was very illegal, and in fact, four Lamar executives have were indicted 2 weeks ago. This was one of the transactions that was named in the
indictment. And what about Eddie Reese ultimately? Did his development projects flop? I think I saw something on TV about that.
Well, he says that he took the $28 million and he put it into developing this property, this DeSoto property. And he had a deal with Lamar that 6 months later, once he had the structural things in, that they would lend him more money to build the homes and so forth. And he claims that when he went back to Lamar to get more money, they reneged and said they weren't going to give him any more. Lamar says that they weren't going to give him any more because he pocketed 10 of the $28 million. Which, of course, he did. I mean, what would you do? So, REO is the problem. Now, there was a bank in Denver, Colorado, that's gotten quite famous, called Silverado. And one of the reasons they're famous is they had a nifty, creative way to get rid of REO. Now, of course, this is the one where Neil Bush is on the board. And in fact, Silverado is kind of a classic example of many of these things that we've talked about. They use these structural changes to build Silverado into an enormous dream. When the bubble burst, they, just like everyone else, had all this REO property. What they did was they set up a little holding company off to the side, and they dumped all their REO in the holding company. Now, this was called the loan pool. And then, when developers came to them, they loaned them much more than than the developers asked for. And the developers would then buy stock in the loan pool.
With the extra money.
With the extra money.
That would keep the bad investments circulating.
And looking great. Right. So they put all these profits on their books.
I see.
Now, Silverado was notorious. They had, at every time they had been examined, they had been warned and cited for excessive bonuses, excessive salaries, insider loans. Michael Wise was the chairman. Silverado loaned him $2.5 million, on which he defaulted. The major stockholder was a guy named Metz. They loaned him $1.5 million, and he defaulted.
Neil Bush's company's got millions of dollars.
Exactly, and they got millions of dollars from two developers that did many of these deals with Silverado, Ken Good and Bill Walters. And in fact, the indictment or the charges against Neil Bush are focused on specific transactions involving those two guys. And they, of course, had helped him set up his oil exploration company.
So he was loaning to his business partners.
Exactly.
He had a conflict of interest because he was on the bank board.
Exactly. Now, it's funny because I'm laughing because during his testimony before Henry Gonzalez's banking committee, he was trying to explain his relationship with Bill Walters. And Frank Annunzio said, your partner was borrowing money from the bank, and you were approving the loans. And Bush said, no. Walters was a partner in my company, but I wasn't a partner with him. So Frank Annunzio, Representative Annunzio, calls this the principle of partneris interruptus.
That sounds like Neil Bush making a good vice president.
Well, I'm sure he had the advice of his dad, who was considered an expert in this field. He headed the the White House task force to oversee deregulation of the SNL industry. And Edwin Gray.
That sounds to me like the worst person possible to get financial advice
exactly.
from.
Exactly.
Because this is such a disaster, this whole apparatus.
That's right. But see, in 1983-84...
It appeared that Bush was on top of things.
Well, and he studied the industry very carefully. Mm-hmm. And Edwin Gray, who was on the committee with him, said that in testimony before Congress, he said that he was delighted to serve with Vice President Bush because Bush was so knowledgeable about the savings and loan industry. Okay. Now, in 85-86 was when the legs got cut out, and that's when Neil Bush went on the board in 1985.
So his timing was bad.
Yeah, one could say that. Now, there's some other things about Silverado. You know, in 1987, they were subject to a big examination, and the examiners recommended that it be closed. A guy named Kermit Mowbray, who was the head of the regional bank board and who was the one to issue the order, declined to do so and said, they're good guys down there, let's work it out with them. Hmm. And so they were allowed to stay in business for another year. And in the summer of 88, they were told that they had to come up with $62 million in cash by October 13th or they were going to be closed. Now, it was right around this time that Neil Bush resigned because his dad had been nominated for to run for president for the Republican Party. Interestingly enough, on October 13th, when the day that they were supposed to close Silverado, actually on October 12th, Kermit Mowbray, who was supposed to issue the order, got a mysterious phone call, you can't remember from whom, from Washington, that said, delay the closing of Silverado. And so, Silverado was not closed until November 9th, one day.
Before the election.
One day after the election.
Or after the election, so that it couldn't become part of the election.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. Now, total cost to the taxpayer? Hard to tell, $1.5 billion, probably, for Silverado.
Silverado loan.
Uh-huh. Five executives have been barred from the industry for life, and charges are going to be brought against Neil Bush. He could have accepted a deal, but he chose to fight. And it appears that the Office of Thrift Supervision is now going to seek a $200 million lawsuit against the board, including Neil Bush.
All over Washington, there's posters, Jail Neil Bush. I was in Washington, D.C. last week. So this is a very big issue there. But I think they're scapegoating him. He was just one of hundreds, maybe thousands,
exactly.
of wheelers and dealers who were playing these games. And everything I've read about Bush, he was pretty light in the head. I mean, he wasn't very intelligent. He was just getting sort of suckered into these things.
Well, I
mean, Michael Weiss pulled him into Silverado, obviously, for his name
well, of course.
And his political connections. It wasn't that Bush had any expertise or that he even knew what he was doing.
Well, he had some experience in banks. He had been a clerk in a bank as a summer job when he was in college.
Because it's New York.
So that's the extent of his experience.
That qualified him to be on the board.
You know? Uh-huh. Right. But, you know, he knew Walters and Good. They'd invested in his company. Mm-hmm. Wise, Walters, and their common lawyer, they all shared a lawyer, were all members of the Chamber of Commerce at the same time. I mean, they were just all cozy little friends.
Now, what's the complicity of Congress in all of this? So far, we've seen that the Reagan deregulation and just stupid banking rules gone amok caused the problem in the first place, which was compounded by the change in the tax laws that made the situation worse, that you didn't know what the game rules were anymore. Now, Congress is supposed to have some responsibility.
Well, they did. I mean, first of all, they passed the two tax reform acts, for one thing,
and
the Garnsey-Germain, and lifting off the cap on deposits. They approved the changes in accounting procedures. Edwin Gray went to Congress. He testified before several congressional committees in 1984 and 1985. He warned this was going to happen. He said there's going to be an enormous taxpayer bailout. You guys are being crazy. He put in regulations. Congress gutted those regulations.
So Congress is
And Congress got rid of Gray.
Right.
Exactly. They refused to renew him.
Yeah. He was the only honest guy in the whole, and they brought in a crony insider in the industry.
Danny Wall.
On our next Alternative Views, we'll continue the savings and loan story, resuming with the Danny Wall story and all of his activities and the way he helped his buddies out. We'll see who the big winners were, the big losers, and of course, in the long run, who will pay. That's you and I, folks. We'll be the ones to pick up the tab. And our taxes will go back to the wealthy folks. So be sure to join us on our next Alternative Views when we continue our story about the savings and loans scandal. We'd like to thank people who helped make the program possible. First of all, our crew for our interview with Rob Whittison. Eric Eubank ran the camera, and Kevin L. West was our audio man. We'd also like to thank a couple of people who helped out greatly in our editing of the program today, Ashley Cook and Christy Greenlee.